Welcome to People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Henry Banks. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm on the phone with Randall Gamble. He is with the Memphis Lynching Sites Project in Memphis, Tennessee, and he joins us tonight to talk about the Memphis Site Project. And Randall, welcome to People of Color. Thank you for taking the time to be on the show today.
Thank you, Henry.
So you are heavily involved in the Lynching Sites Project in Memphis. Would you take a moment to tell our listeners about the Memphis project that you're working on?
Yeah, it's called the Lynching Site Project of Memphis. It was started in 2015. Brian Stevenson, you know, from the Equal Justice Initiative, came here to Memphis in November of 2015, and he gave a talk at the Facing History in Ourself banquet, which had over maybe 700 people. And what eventually happened is several people had attended that, you know, that banquet, and a seed was actually planted. They met at the church and started discussing, you know, what they're going to do about it and stuff like that, right? So they started, you know, getting together with other, you know, community people and stuff like that. And so that's how it got started.
So how many lynchings actually occurred in Memphis, Tennessee, or in Shelby County, as I believe Memphis is located in Shelby County?
Well, originally the number was 21. We're up to 35. We have a Dr. Margaret Van Diver that actually, she's a retired professor from the University of Memphis Criminology. She wrote a book called Lethal Punishment. So we have a research committee which she's on, and she started doing a lot of the research that actually, you know, started looking at, you know, exactly the numbers of lynching. And we're right at 35. We're doing pretty much four right now. The other ones, like I said, we'll get to it.
Sure. Now, I met you in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, probably about a month or so ago, and was intrigued by your work in Memphis, Tennessee, and wanted to get your message out to my listeners here in this particular region of Wisconsin Public Radio. Can you talk more about the project, what your goals are, and what you're hoping to get out of this as it relates to educating our kids and educating the nation about lynchings and the impact of lynchings on our country?
Well, I remember several people who went to the actual Face of History and Ourself banquet came back, and they remember four things that Brian Stevenson talked about. There were four points he made. One was you have to get close, proximity. You have to get close to whatever it is that you're doing. The second one, you have to change the narrative. The narrative around lynching was written from a very different perspective, not mainly from people of color. The third is you have to stay hopeful. And the fourth is you have to be willing to be uncomfortable. So I think a lot of them, that four principles, where it is, right, is pretty much what we use, I mean, in terms of looking at, you know, let's say vision and mission statement and goals. But we do have, you know, a vision and mission statement and goals about what we really want to be about. We want to, you know, kind of shine the light of truth, which comes from Ida B. Wells, of shine the light of truth, you know, in the dark area. The mission statement is really about, you know, working together to bring people from maybe many different parts of the community, congregations, schools, universities, art, theater, young people together, where it is, to do this work. And our goal is really is many. It's grounded in, you know, in humility and prayer. It's about, you know, pretty much having a relationship with, you know, many different people that are already doing some type of racial healing work, you know, in the community, where we're not reinventing the wheel, and to partner, you know, with so many different, you know, churches and synagogues and mosques or whatever it is, right? But the main thing is also to make sure that we include young people. So we have a youth involvement committee, you know, which is, you know, where we're working with, you know, Face of History and Ourselves in terms of the youth, and they're doing some fabulous work. The one area is art and art and theater. It's so important, you know, to connect with people involved in, you know, artists and theater plays and stuff like that. Because you heard about The Strange Fruit, which is going to happen April 6th. So that's going to be wonderful. We're pretty much involved, you know, with Hadaloo Theater and Memphis Symphony Orchestra. So there's a lot of things to engage the community, because it's not just the Lynching Site Project of Memphis, which includes, you know, of course, you know, maybe 30 people to come to the meeting, but it's the whole community. community. We want to impact the whole community.
I know I'm here with Randall Gamble. He is from Memphis, Tennessee, and he's working on a major project in that part of the country. I always ask my guests when I talk about or have guests on the show to talk about lynchings, a lot of people still believe lynchings only occurred in the South. And so we had lynchings up here in northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin. And so can you talk about your work in context to work going on all over the country, really?
Well, I think I got started. I think God moved me in 2006. I was at a conference up in Milwaukee in 2006, and I didn't recognize until later on that year that there was a Dr. James Cameron, who was a known survivor of a lynching. His museum that he started, American Black Holocaust Museum, was probably maybe 5 or 6 blocks away from the conference, and I didn't really know it. But I started, learning about him, about what happened to him, in 1930, Marion, Indiana, him becoming the known survivor of a lynching. And I read his book, A Time of Terror. But that really is what really started moving me towards looking at confronting, the legacy of racial terror. The Bryan Stevenson report came out in 2015.
Mm-hmm. So as I looked on your website today and this past weekend, you mentioned facing history and ourselves, a community teach-in that's coming up in Memphis, Tennessee, and the area on April 20th. I was intrigued by the fact that students are going to be leading the breakout sessions, that they're going to be presenting a variety of different things related to lynchings, but that's going to be 45 student facilitators in 16 schools. I'm wondering how that was ever pulled off, because that seems pretty remarkable to me.
Well, when we started, looking at youth, what's interesting, Henry, is that long before the Lynching Site Project of Memphis got started, there was a high school, that had a teacher that was, of course, familiar with face history and ourselves, and she challenged the students. These were juniors and stuff like that. In 2015, they were doing a project, and the project that they came up with was to actually do something around L. Person. L. Person was lynched, of course, 100 years ago in May 1917. Not only did they do that project and do the research on L. Person, they also started fundraising to raise funds to actually create a historical marker, for L. Person, which is interesting. And then another thing that they actually started doing was working to establish a nonprofit called SUMS, which is Students United Against Memphis. So we had a lot of, facing history and ourselves, teachers, and, a lot of members, in the Lynching Site Project of Memphis involved. But April 20th is going to be quite interesting, because the actual students, over probably be about 1,500 students, and then all of the facilitators will be students, are going to be actually talking about the L. Person lynching and stuff like that. That's amazing. And I think a lot of it came because of our relationship with, facing history and ourselves, and having teachers. We do have several teachers, that come to our meetings and stuff like that, that are involved. And so it's really just an amazing, to see the young people, take the lead, with the support, of the teachers and faculties and stuff like that. So I'm looking forward, to that. Yeah, I mean, because I just think it's so important. They say that, children are our future. Well, they also are now. So we can, so we have to allow them to be able to express, their gifts and talents right now.
And that's a demographic that we often overlook. And I admire you all for making sure that young people are included in that particular part of education, because if we don't educate our children and ourselves about what reality is as it relates to our country, we'll be talking about this stuff forever with regard to, how do we make our community better?
Yes.
We can't make our community better until we start to acknowledge and realize some of these atrocities that occurred in our country make our country what it is today, with regard to racism and racial activity and all kinds of negative things. And so it's important for us to come together and talk about even the negative.
Yeah, I agree, Henry. I think a lot of the negativity of things that are coming to the surface, that are happening around racial tension and stuff like that, like what happened, you know, with the young man in Seattle, you know, they got Fountain in the Woods, and what happened in Manhattan, you know, New York, about the, you know, the white guy that actually, you know, stabbed the black guy.
Yes.
I think a lot of these things are coming to the surface to the point where it's out there now. It cannot be ignored. And I think our young people and many people are starting to come together and having some serious conversation around race and white privilege. You can't ignore it because it's there. You know what I mean? And I think, you know, a lot of these atrocities is doing one thing. I think it's bringing us together to be able to, you know, I mean, to talk about it in real ways that we have not talked about before.
And I suspect in the work that you all are doing in Memphis, Tennessee, that you've probably gotten pushback, or have you received pushback from this work?
Well, when we first started in 2015, we went out to the community, and we had what they call circles of listening. We wanted to hear from the community. It wasn't so much us, you know, trying to say, okay, this is going to be this way. We wanted to hear from, you know, real people in the community. But so far, like I said, it's been very positive. People have been very supportive and stuff like that. We had just got an historical marker, you know, approved by the Shelby County Historical Society, you know, which we thought there was going to be some, you know, pushback or whatever it is, right? But we haven't really yet got any, I would say, some overly negative connotation about the work that we're doing. You know, of course, the question is, why are you doing that? You know, why are you bringing up the past? Because
right.
I truly believe that the past, you know, reflects the present.
Mm-hmm. And in order for us to move forward, we have to deal with the past, because the past is a part of who we are today.
I agree.
In your work on the lynching sites in Memphis, Tennessee, what additional work or activities will you be, or are you engaged in that city?
You talking about additional work?
Yes. What other things are you doing down in Memphis, Tennessee that are making positive changes in your community?
Well, I think one of the things, Henry, that just happened last Saturday, which was wonderful, we got invited to the Memphis Muslim Festival. And they invited us to have a booth there and stuff like that. And I tell you, that was just an overwhelming support, you know, to be there with our brothers and sisters who are Muslim and stuff like that. Because we know, you know, looking at, you know, the news and a lot of things going on, there have been a lot of mosques and a lot of things that are happening. But just to, you know, to be present with our, you know, Muslim brothers and sisters, right, to connect with that community was just a real boost. And we had a table, a booth there, and many people came and they had a lot of questions, you know, and it was just so wonderful, you know, to be able to, you know, to be able to engage with each other. There is a Afro-American Muslim woman that talked about us, and she's going to join us next week and stuff like that, right, to be a part of this. So I just find that we have to cross all these different barriers, you know, whether or not we're talking about gender, race, or religion and stuff, to really come together, you know, I mean, as one, you know, from people from all the, you know, the different elements, you know, in society and stuff like that. That's not always easy, especially when you're talking about a very sensitive subject as, you know, as lynching.
Mm-hmm. I know prior to our interview, you know, when I contacted you asking you to be on People of Color, your first response to me was that you pray and that
yeah.
you wanted to make sure that this was the right thing and that you prayed before you made the decision to come on the show. Can you talk about, you know, that part of you and why for you prayer is so important to the work you do?
Well, growing up the way I did, I grew up in Oakland, California. And, you know, going to church was a, you know, was a good thing. I mean, you had to, you know, you had to go to church whether or not you want to or not. But I find that prayer, it gets me out the way, you know what I mean, and allows God to be in charge. But prayer helps me to, you know, to recognize that this work that I'm doing is not something that I chose. It was something that was chosen for me. So I find that, you know, that offering, you know, prayer to God, you know, and be open to, you know, the moving of the Spirit, where God leads me, allows me to have that peace in knowing that this is the work that God has called for me to do. So I don't get the big head, you know, and think it's all about me, because it's not. It's about God, and it's about, to me, it's about building God's kingdom. So I find that, you know, having prayer or some form of spirituality, however people name it, is very important, because I find that to be on a mission is a calling, and I believe that to do this work, which is very emotional, very psychological, you have to be rooted in something that's bigger than yourself. So I find that, you know, being open, you know, to pray, but being open to receive, you know, the answer from God, however it comes, wherever it is, right, is very important, you know, I mean, so that it keeps you rooted in humility, forgiveness, and peace, and love.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I'm here with Randall Gamble. He is with the Memphis, Tennessee Lynching Site Project from Memphis, Tennessee. I'm so honored that you're on the show today. And I've been to Memphis, Tennessee one time, and I was there for a convention of the Church of God in Christ, which has their headquarters there. And I remember as my family and I, we were getting ready to leave Memphis, and we decided we were going to go over to the Civil Rights Museum, the Lorraine Motel,
uh-huh,
to, you know, visit there. But when we arrived, we could not get in. There was a protest going on at the time, and I remember it distinctly because they had literally shut the facility down because they did not want it to be a museum. I'm not sure if you're aware of that year. I can't remember the year when that happened, but it was very, very interesting to see all the people there, and they were protesting. They had signs. They were not allowing people to be on the premises because they did not want it to be a museum. It is a museum now. Can you talk a little bit for our listeners? Would you share with them a little bit about that particular facility in your town?
Well, I know a little bit about the Lorraine Hotel.
Sure, sure.
Because my church is right down the street. And plus that I know the late, I've talked with the late Judge Diami Bailey. He was the one that actually, you know, did a lot of the behind-the-scene work to get it right, to get it to become the National Civil Rights Museum. But I find that, you know, after Dr. King got killed in 68, that whole area became kind of a ghost town.
Yes.
Stuff like that. But what eventually happened was there was also a lady that had passed away at the same time after she heard Dr. King, but I think what happened is that it stayed open because it was a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And a lot of people with Judge Diami Bailey, you know, after he went to California, you know, and stuff like that, right? But they wanted to do something to recognize, you know, the life and legacy of Dr. King. So it took a lot of work, you know what I mean, that Judge Diami Bailey and many other people did to make it the National Civil Rights Museum, which is a wonderful thing because it gets people from all over. But what's interesting, Henry, is that when it had closed for remodeling, you know what I mean, because they wanted to actually add some new stuff like slavery and stuff like that.
Sure.
So it reopened, and it's just amazing because a lot of things, it wasn't just about civil rights, but it was all about human rights and what came before civil rights. And so we get a lot of people. As a matter of fact, I'm going there Thursday evening because they're going to be having a meeting to talk about the 50th anniversary next year. You know, a planning meeting on what to do, you know, concerning the 50th anniversary next year in 2018.
So that area is now historically designated, if I'm not if I'm correct on that, or not correct, would you correct me on that? Is that a historical area?
I don't know if it is or not. If that area is considered historical, the Civil Rights Museum might be. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Because you're over there by, you know, South Bluff or wherever it is, and that whole area used to be warehouses and stuff like that, and that whole area is being changed, you know, into lofts and stuff like that. But I'm not sure if it's considered an historical area.
Okay, can you tell me where it is in proximity to the Church of God in Christ headquarters, Mason Temple? How far is it from there?
Off of Mason Temple, you're talking about where Dr. King gave his last mountaintop speech.
Right. Right.
Get confused between Mason Temple and Claiborne Temple.
Right, I mean, it was Mason Temple, yes.
I would say probably, because it's on Mudbury, you know, I would say probably maybe no more than probably a mile.
Okay.
Less than a mile.
Okay, so pretty close.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. So that's very cool. So I want to ask you, Randall, if you would take a moment and talk about, you know, we are now in this country talking about racism and racial issues and how all of a sudden in our country it feels as though, for many people, as though we are back in the 50s and 60s. What is the racial climate like in Memphis, Tennessee right now?
Well, I've been in Memphis about 24 years, and been involved in different workshops of people coming together around racial healing, racial reconciliation, and stuff like that. But I find that what I see happening, in spite of the economics, you know, that, you know, of poverty and a lot of things, but I see more people starting to come together, both black and white, and other ethnicities, are really starting to come together to really grapple with this history. Because sometimes we think we're moving forward, but at the same time, we're moving backwards. But I find that in Memphis, there are many, especially young people, that are really, there's a lot of positive things, because it's easy to look at the negative things because they're advertised more. But I find that I try to look at what is positive, what's happening, what's moving people, young people, older people, just people in general, in terms of looking at how do we deal, you know. And you got the whole, I'm going to give you a prime example, Henry. You know, the I-40 bridge incident. Did you hear about that?
Yes.
You know, about the Black Lives Matter?
Yes.
But, what, you know, and people, you know, have their own perspective about what they thought, you know, I mean, you know, about what happened based on where they were. But what came out of that is that even in the midst of the Black Lives Matter movement, there was several pastors that actually met. It was over 300-something pastors met at this church. And what happened is it became known as the Memphis Christian Pastors Network. And what's amazing, Henry, is that from this gathering and ministers meeting together, they had a retreat, and that retreat was called Healing Memphis Wounded History. Well, last month, two of the ministers, you know, talked to, you know, several of the people at LSP, which we call, you know, Lynching Site Project, about taking them to the actual one of the lynching sites. So we took 100 ministers to the actual lynching site of El Person last month. There was two busloads, and I have never seen the minister so quiet. It was just truly amazing, because they were on, I call, hollow ground or holy ground. And that, to me, you know, is some of the things that come out of this negativity. Sometimes a lot of the negativity, that's what people see, but they don't see, you know, how sometimes that negativity is transformed into something different. So we've been working with a lot of churches, you know, church partnerships and stuff like that, visiting churches, you know, and meeting with pastors, you know, to really, you know, to listen, to hear, you know, what's going on with them, or, you know, I mean, you know, and them, I'm talking about both men and women who are pastors or whatever it is, right, and rabbis or whatever it is, right. And so I find that positive, you know, I mean, even in the midst of the divide, they said 11 o'clock is the most segregated hour. But I find that when I see people, you know, at least coming together and stuff like that, and talking to each other. I think it was not too long ago, we had the 125th anniversary of the People's Grocery, you know, what happened to the three, you know, black men that got lynched.
Mm-hmm.
And there were black and white ministers that probably, you know, got a chance to meet with each other, because we met at the actual great Zion Cemetery, which is one of the oldest African-American cemetery in Memphis, whoever it is, right? And we all, you know, they did a commemoration there. And then we all went to one of the historical, you know, African-American, you know, church, you know, Second Congregation, and did a program there. And then we all walked together down to his historical marker. There's a historical marker that was placed there in 1991. And then, but just to see people come together, you know, both black and white, that probably have not really known each other, that to me is transforming. And I think that's what we need, not only to come together, but after we come together, how do we remain together, you know, in terms of talking about these issues that you're talking about in a city that is, you know, very, probably more than, you know, 50 to 55, 60% African-American.
For all intents and purposes, I know that Memphis is a rather large city.
Mm-hmm.
And so, having heard what you just said about the segregated piece on Sunday, you know, at 11 a.m., how do we get over those kinds of things in our country? You know, how do we really live as a beloved community that Dr. King implored us to be, you know, way back in the 60s? That was one thing Dr. King implored us to become across the country, and we're still struggling to become the beloved community. And he also said that the biggest thing that we would be dealing with in this country would be that thing of race and racism.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for the places of worship, I think, you know, you have to it's not a big thing that you try to do, you know, by transforming the whole place of worship. I think Henry, you do it by building relationships with each other, you know, across these divide. You know, you might, you know, go to somebody's place of worship and not only just go there just to, you know, you're not just being a mark, but to go there and stuff like that, right? I go to a lot of places that, you know, predominantly white over mm-hmm. it is, right? You know, and meet with people, right? But you have to be willing to be uncomfortable, to go places where, you know, where you are different, so to speak, whoever it is, right? But I find that there was, I'll give you a prime example. I remember there was a church that had the Nealands. You ever heard the Nealands? The Nealands were, you know, where people were, you know, college people, both black and white, came together and actually went to churches, you know, stuff like the sit-ins, but they call them kneel-ins. Well, there was one place that actually had a kneel-in, and I went to its 50th anniversary, or wherever it is, right? And you have to look at the structure, the whole structure, policies of churches, you know what I mean? What is your policy? Because you had segregation, you had Jim Crow, wherever it is, right? You have to look at all these dynamics, or wherever it is, because it's not just individual, it's systemic, or wherever it is, right? But you got to look at all these dynamics that are playing into, you know, why you have, you know, urban and suburban and church, you know, here, there, and there. But how do we really work together, you know, in a way that's real? But you have to meet people right where they are.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Now, I know back in the era of the Ku Klux Klan, they used the burning of a cross as their symbol of hate, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know, but in your opinion, do you believe that that was a carryover to some of the reason why churches were so segregated?
Well, that might have, well, I think a lot of that had to do with after slavery, you know, when we went to Reconstruction or whatever it is, right, there was still that white supremacy dynamic or whatever it is, right, that was still happening, you know. And with the Klan, of course, the Klan started, you know, in Pulaski, Tennessee or wherever it is, right, kind
right.
of a social, wherever it is, right. But they started for a purpose. I mean, you know, and it's interesting that you say the Klan, because I met a former Klan member, 4 years ago, who was actually way up there in the Klan. Now he's doing racial reconciliation work. So it's interesting. But I find that all these elements of white supremacy, I think we have to understand white supremacy, white privilege, and what that did to whites and to people of color. Because we've all been impacted by the brutality of the past, but at the same time, we've also been impacted by whites who actually took a stand against lynching, against racial violence, and all the things that play into it. But I think we still go back to white supremacy and white privilege because even after, you know, slavery and Reconstruction and Jim Crow, everything was legal by law.
Mm-hmm. I know in the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial Project, I was the co-founder of that organization, and mm-hmm. I know we did have a former KKK member that was a part of our planning efforts in Duluth, Minnesota, and he was a wonderful person. And, you know, his people change.
Yes.
And that's what I always say to folks. People change. And so we have to give people opportunities for healing and understanding and, you know, whatever it takes, we have to do that.
Henry, there's a wonderful African-American guy that actually interviewed a Klan. His name is Dale Davis. There's a movie, a documentary just came out called Accidental Courtesy, or wherever it is. Dale Davis, a singer, a musician, or wherever it is, and he was playing and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was playing somewhere on the East Coast, or wherever it is, right? And one of the white guys came up to him, you know, and said, "Man, how you play like Jerry Lee Lewis, or wherever it is, right?" But that was the invite. And so he said, "Man, I want to bring my friends." Well, the white guy that liked how he played, his friends were all Klan members, right? So it gave him a curiosity. He wanted to see, you know, what these people were like. So he eventually interviewed a Klan by having a secretary call the Grand Wizard, or whatever it is, right? And actually interviewed the Klan. I mean, saw their robes and everything. And he wrote a book called Klan Destined. It's amazing, man.
What was the name of that book again?
I think it's called Klan Destined.
Okay.
Klan Destined.
Okay.
Yeah, Dale Davis.
All right.
It's amazing, man. You know, of how I say how God works in mysterious ways and just does wonders and stuff like that. Because an African American man going to, you know, these places or wherever it is, just amazing. Yeah. And then end up, a lot of them were changed by, you know, just encounter. He said, I want to get to know you as a person, you know what I mean? Not because of what you represent, but because of who we are as human beings. So it's just amazing.
And as you mentioned earlier, it's about building relationships.
Absolutely.
I'm here with Randall Gamble from the Lynching Sites Project in Memphis, Tennessee. It's wonderful to have you on the show today. I know that the project that you're working on down there, you know, you said some 25, 35 lynching sites have been identified in your city. Do you expect there will be more?
Probably. I think, Henry, there is a lot of things that are not talked about. And maybe because it's too painful. I think underneath there's a lot of wounds that people carry from years past that we don't even know about. Now, we just scratched the surface. Some things are very obvious, you know, the 1892 People's Groceries or whatever it is, right, because the Ivy Wells. But I think there's a lot of people out there, far and near, that probably had somebody that was probably lynched in their family that they don't want to talk about. And I think as we continue to do this work, it is seeking the people, you know what I mean, they're invisible, you know what I mean? And you have to respect people's boundaries. Some of it is just too emotional. You know, it's too tough to talk about. And you have to respect that. But I think a lot of things, as we continue to build momentum around this with Brian Stevenson, EGI, and a lot of the other things that are taking place, I think people might come forward and they might, you know, be able to, you know, I mean, to be moved by the Spirit, you know, to speak their truth, you know what I mean? And I'm hopeful, you know, and that's what the, you know, having faith is all about, being hopeful that people will come forward eventually. Or you might encounter someone and just might happen to have a conversation. All of a sudden they start talking about, somebody was lynched, whatever it is, right? So I think it's going to happen, but it's going to happen in God's timing.
Absolutely. Now, earlier you mentioned Pulaski, Tennessee as being the headquarters for the Ku Klux Klan. Where is Pulaski, Tennessee with, I say, proximity to Memphis? How, you know, is it near Memphis or is it quite a ways away?
No, Pulaski is going east. You have, it's like eastern, being on the southern eastern part, you know, of Tennessee. It's a little ways from Memphis, but it's on the southern part of Tennessee. You know?
And so the reason I ask that question is I'm wondering what kind of community it is today.
Oh, that's a good question. That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know.
Sure.
That's a great question.
Yeah, wondering, you know, if it had been integrated or if people were, you know, welcoming of all people there. Because, again, like I said, people change. Communities change.
Yes, and that's a great question, Henry.
Mm-hmm. So if I were, or if those who are listening now were interested in getting involved in the work that you're doing in Memphis, Tennessee, even way up north here, how might they do that?
To get involved into the work that we're doing.
That you're doing, if they want more information, if they want to send a contribution to your organization, is there a way to do that?
Yeah, they can go to the website. We have a website, lynchingsitemen.org. Or they can go to the Facebook. We have a Facebook page.
Okay.
They can go to both, and it has information of who to contact, how to make a donation, if people want to make a donation and stuff like that. And I just think it's important that we talk to each other, you know, across, you know, the states and everything about the different things that people are doing, because that's how we grow. We grow from learning from each other's experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I want to take this time to thank you, Randall Gamble from Memphis, Tennessee, for being on People of Color today. Is there anything else you want to share with, leave with our listeners before we close the conversation?
Well, I would say that, look at where you are, you know, and look at what you can do around race relations, because there's enough work for everybody, you know, to do and stuff like that, right? And connect with people, not blame or shame, but how do we work together to claim deliverance for all of us in a way that's real and stuff like that. But working together, you know, based on where people are, because, you know, race relations, like I said, it's not easy. You know what I mean? And you want to connect with people that are involved. I don't care if it's Black Lives Matter movement or the women movement or whatever it is, right? Connect where you are, you know, peace movement or whatever it is, you know what I mean, where you are. but at the same time, also be open to connect with people in other areas, as me and you have connected in actual Milwaukee, because our connection, our human connection, is what creates the dots. And the dots, as we continue to connect the dots, they get bigger and bigger. And I call it, Henry, as we connect the dots, we'll build a globe.
Absolutely. And that is that building of the beloved community that Dr. King inspires all of us to become.
That's right.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Henry.
Have a great weekend.
All right, man. You too, man.
Bye. Bye.
We studied People's Grocery, which was a grocery store that was located on the corner of Mississippi and Walker. It was owned by Thomas Moss and three of his other associates. And Thomas was a good friend of Ida B. Wells's, and her residence was where the YWCA is located, right across the street. When some of you have parked your cars. The story behind the People's Grocery is the story of Thomas and his associates lynching, which has two stories behind it, which can be used on either occasion. One story is that Thomas had competition with a white store owner who had a store not too far from Thomas's, and that the white store owner got jealous because of all the business that Thomas's store was getting, and he started to pick a fight with Thomas, and that caused Thomas to kill one of the white store owners, and that caused him to be jailed. But later that night, the white store owner and his other associates, the ones who were not killed, came and kidnapped him from the jail and lynched him. This sparked IDL's anti-lynching campaign, the lynching of Thomas Moss. But the other story is that there were boys, both white and black, playing marbles outside of Thomas's store, and they got into a scuffle, and that caused Thomas and the white store owners to get into a conflict, which resulted in Thomas killing one of the white store owners again and being lynched. This event sparked one huge movement that caused Ida B. Wells to write several articles about anti-lynching, and those articles caused her to have to move outside of Memphis, and this caused a big movement of African Americans to move outside of Memphis. All these little events came from one small thing that happened right across the street from us. And it's important for us to learn about these things because it's part of our history as Memphis and as African Americans. Thank you.
In April of 1917, the big news in America was our nation's changing role in the First World War. The talk of the town was the bizarre murder of 15-year-old Antoinette Rappel. The girl's body was found in a wooded area near the Wolf River. Her head had been severed from her body with what appeared to be an axe. One of the men arrested and questioned that day was 30-year-old L. Persons, a black woodcutter who lived near the area, after being accused of the crime by a local deaf and mute man who claimed to have witnessed the murder. Persons was sent to Nashville to await trial, but upon arrival back to Memphis a week later, Persons was apprehended by a mob which overtook law enforcement officers as he was being transported to jail. Now, since the L. Persons lynching took place almost 100 years ago, no one who actually witnessed the event is still living today. Therefore, the only place where you can get detailed information concerning this incident is here at the U of M Library.
Edwin Frank, curator of the U of M Library's Special Collections, explains the climate of the times.
You know, there may be an image that lynching is a matter of an uncontrollable mob or an uncontrollable crowd, acting on the spur of the moment, but as a matter of fact, as you say, in this case and in some others, it was almost advertised.
May 22, 1917, at 9 a.m., the mob took persons to the Macon Road Bridge, the site where Antoinette Rappel's body was found. There was no evidence of his guilt. Persons eventually confessed to the crime as the lynch mob held an impromptu court in the woods in front of a crowd of over 5,000 spectators. Persons was then tied to a log, doused in gasoline, and set ablaze, being burned alive for the captive and gleeful audience. The headline in the next morning's commercial appeal. The paper defended the conduct of the lynching spectators, commending the fact that no one in the crowd got drunk, yelled, or shot off firearms. L. Person's public killing was the last officially documented lynching in Memphis. For Insight, I'm LaShawn Fawcett.
We're people before a soil, trying to make our way, a better thing.
5,000 people showed up for it.
Won't you call a brand new day?
Newspapers advertised it.
Parents even let their kids out of school to watch.
They watched a man burn alive.
L. Persons, a black woodcutter, was accused of killing a white schoolgirl. He was forcibly removed from police custody, taken to the Wolf River Bridge on Macon Road, and burned alive.
The body was finally pulled from the fire and dismembered. They drove down to Bill Street and they threw pieces of L. Persons at black pedestrians.
Today, few Memphians have ever heard of L. Persons.
L. Persons.
L. Persons.
L. Persons.
L. Persons.
Well, most people don't understand that lynching was racial terrorism because it wasn't just the people who were victimized, it was the entire community.
The Lynching Sites Project of Memphis is committed to educating the community about our shared history and using this awareness to help move us all forward. Your contributions can make a meaningful difference while helping to honor the families whose lives have been impacted by lynching and racial violence.
It's time.
It's time.
When you were around 19 years old, Martin Luther King got assassinated.
No, I was older than that. I was a senior in college.
Okay, so you're about 22 or so?
I was 21.
21. Okay, so you clearly remember as an adult the impact of that situation.
Well, for me, that was a small impact. I wound up being the last judge hearing the James Earl Ray matter. Did he, in fact, assassinate Dr. Martin Luther King? And had he not died and his local attorney not died in close succession, it would have been my finding that he was not the gunman. That Remington 760 Game Master they've got in the Civil Rights Museum is not the murder weapon. It's not even close. And it was a two-man hit team that killed him from the fire station dormitory. It wasn't the flop house and it wasn't in those bushes. So yeah, I got into the deep details of Dr. King. And that 3 or 4 year period, that case was kicking around in front of me.
So you're saying that the James Earl Ray did not kill Martin Luther King?
No, he didn't kill him.
Even though most people, well, he was convicted for it, right?
He didn't kill him. it's interesting, the homicide file for the Memphis Police Department reaches the same conclusion back in 1968. They entered their file in protest to the DA's office. Their conclusion was, Ray is not the gunman. He was not even in Memphis that day. We know conclusively where he was.
So why do you think he got convicted for the murder?
Well, he didn't get convicted. He pled guilty. You have to understand, though, the news media puts it out as he was the self-confessed killer of King. That's not true. All through the transcripts, the entirety of the record, he never confessed, and often he said, I never said I killed King. I didn't kill him. I'm pleading cause of Alford. That's A-L-F-O-R-D. It's a moderately old U.S. Supreme Court case, and it says, even if you are not actually guilty and you are pristinely innocent, you may plead guilty to the charge if you think that doing so is in your best interest under all of the circumstances as you know them to be, and you're doing so freely, voluntarily, understandingly, knowingly, advisedly, and intelligently. So Ray had gone through all of these and had lost, but there was something that came up. Modern scientific methodology took away one further necessary element. All of these things had to be there, and the state had to have a reasonable factual basis upon which to proceed otherwise. The thing the state relied upon was the rifle, but modern scientific methodology excluded that rifle from being the murder weapon. The bullet they pull out of King's body has a rate of rifling twist of one turn in every 11 1/4 inches. The rifle that Ray had a rate of rifling twist of one turn in every 10 inches in a bad manufacturing defect that is not apparent on the death slug. He was shot with an XM-21. It's a 7.62 by 51 millimeter NATO caliber weapon with a special stainless steel barrel, a 3-9 telescopic sight modified by a company known as Leatherwood. It was a Redfield sight, and they used special subsonic ammunition with a suppressor on the end to reduce the velocity of the bullet to below supersonic to confuse the sound signature. The shot came from the dormitory in the fire station through a window that had been slightly parted. They were several feet inside. It was a two-man team, a spotter and a shooter. That's what he got killed by. If you shoot somebody at that closer range, which was about 50, 60 yards, with a 30 caliber rifle anywhere in the torso, if the individual is standing next to an emergency room, it's a non-survivable wound. But what they did is they took a headshot they almost missed because the bullet was reduced in velocity. It hit King on the right cheek, took out some molars, wrecked his tongue, came out between his jaws, left the body, hit his clavicle, ricocheted under the skin that covered the clavicle, nicked his carotid artery, went over his right shoulder, down across the back, and lodged between the left scapula and his back skin. And the bullet never penetrated his thorax. Now that sounds a little weird, but it's not uncommon. So he bled out from the nicked carotid artery, and they almost missed the shot. And Ray was nowhere around.
So had he lived, you would have actually found James Earl Ray not guilty and released him from prison?
Well, he would have been close. He had another involvement in this whole thing, and that was that he was a willing part of what amounted to a conspiracy. He was one of about 4 or 5 alternative scapegoats. And they picked him for a number of reasons. I did talk to a Captain Tommy Smith, who retired as head of homicide for the Memphis Police Department, who was the first detective on the scene. He said the shot couldn't have been from the flop house because there was a window that he was supposed to fire the shot out of, and who told me that, I never found out. He said, but there was a limb about this thick growing diagonally through the window, and you couldn't even see the Lorraine Motel from that location. He said, I came back with crime scene in about an hour, and the whole tree had been cut down, and I found out there was a cut down order sent out to the sanitation department early that day, but they were on strike, so they weren't going to cut it down. So, you know, it gets back to the show. We're going to start bringing some reality back to television that's not the kind of dysfunctional reality that's so popular these days. We're going to start, you should have gotten this in the fourth, fifth, or sixth grade. You didn't. I know you didn't, but here's what the rule is, and let's see if you can become good Americans because of it. Be brave, be honorable, be forthright, stand up, be counted. See, I always said something bad about this so-called international war on terror. This is just an interesting thing that I did. I said, we live in the land of the free and the home of the brave. What are we supposed to be so terrified for? Hundreds of thousands of Americans have been injured or died trying to secure freedom and liberty. So we're going to give it up because we got slightly scared. Be brave. Stand up.